Okay. Kenichi, you're still on. Contingent settlements. Paper 6.
Thank you, Wayne. This agenda paper 6 addresses two issues related to the classification of a share-based payment. Issue A is how to classify a share-based payment transaction in which the manner of settlement is contingent on a future event that is outside the control of both parties. Issue B is how to classify a share-based payment transaction in which the manner of settlement is contingent on a future event that is within the control of the counterparty. For issue A, in the May 2013 meeting, the committee asked the staff to explore approaches for adding specific guidance to IFRS 2 for the classification of this type of share-based payment transaction to solve the diversity in practice. In response to the request, we prepared 5 alternative approaches, including the 3 sub-approaches as shown in this agenda paper. At first, we analyzed the classification of this share-based payment transaction for issue A. As described in our staff analysis, we found that there would be pros and cons for each approach, but on balance, we are of the view that approach B would be the most appropriate approach to amending IFRS 2. Under approach B, the share-based payment would be classified as cash settled if it is probable that it will be settled in cash or as assets. We noted that this share-based payment is settled all in cash or all in equity instruments, depending on the outcome on an uncertain future event that is outside control of both parties. We thought that this characteristic could support the view that this share-based payment is just a single share-based payment, and its manner of settlement changes as the most likely settlement scenario changes. We thought that if this view was taken, this share-based payment transaction should be classified on the basis of whether it is probable that share-based payment will be settled in cash. And secondly, we analyzed how to account for classification change if approach B was taken for the classification issue. We identified 2 accounting methods. Method 1 is to account for change in the classification as a failure to satisfy non-market vesting condition. And method 2 is to account for changing the classification as a modification of the terms and conditions of the share-based payment transaction. In our view, the method 2 would be the most appropriate method for the accounting for the classification change that arises from a change in the most likely settlement scenario. This is because the share-based payment still continues even after the change in the classification. We also noted that it would be inappropriate to record a gain or loss from a change in the classification when the fair value of both alternatives on the date of the reclassification is the same. Accordingly, if the committee thinks that IFRS 2 could be amended to solve this issue, we think that the committee should propose a narrow scope amendment to IFRS 2 in line with approach B and method 2 described in this agenda paper. We also think that this amendment should be proposed together with the amendment recommended in March 2013 that addresses the reclassification from cash settled to equity settled, because the amendment under method 2 would need to refer to the new guidance for changing the classification from cash settled to equity settled. For issue B, we just carried forward our analysis from the previous staff paper. And as stated in this paper, the results of our outreach indicate that share-based payment transaction in issue B is not significantly widespread. So we recommend to the committee that it should not change the previous decision not to add this issue to its agenda. Do you agree with the staff recommendation for issue A and issue B?
Okay, we're talking about the questions that begin on page 18. Okay. The one question I had, and Scott, you may be able to help us out on this from the perspective of U.S. GAAP. The paper is drafted in terms of an event that is outside of the control of both the entity and the employee. So it's not a management issue. It's the entity is the contracting party and the employee. When I got to the citation of U.S. GAAP that you said, it focuses only on events that are outside the control of the employee, and specifically uses an IPO as an example of something that would be within the control of the entity but outside the control of the employee.
I don't think an IPO is within the control of the entity either.
Well, they can certainly decide whether or not to do one.
Yeah, but don't we ask about
something? Well, that says that what we're really worried about is a successful IPO is outside the control.
Yes.
Okay. That, I think, answers my question.
I mean, although I think in U.S. GAAP, if the trigger was filing for an IPO, we'd probably say that filing for an IPO is within the control
right.
of the company, and that would also be evaluated based on the probable guidance.
Okay. All right, then. Tony, I think you were first up.
Couple of thoughts. With this one, not sure there is actually significant diversity in practice. I'm aware that there are differing views on how you might account for it, but I think there's probably a fairly consistent view actually applied in practice, which is consistent with the idea of accounting for whichever one seems probable, but then truing it up effectively as a change in estimate. And I think that's what generally happens in practice at the moment, would be my experience. And so I'm not sure that I necessarily see a need for this, but if the committee feels that we ought to go ahead and clarify IFRS 2, then I agree that you would account for whichever of the two options seems probable. But I disagree with the notion of accounting for it as a modification simply because nothing's been modified. These were the terms in the original agreement with the employees. We don't, for example, account for a modification if the share-based payment plan gets changed because of some sort of capital restructuring, if the requirement to amend what the employees receive changes as a result of a capital restructuring. So I think that to account for it as a modification is to account for something that really hasn't happened, and that a true-up adjustment is the better answer. I also, and I know that you've used a specific example in here where you say, would it be appropriate to recognize a gain? I think if you change the fact pattern, it would end up being a loss, and that just reflects different circumstances. So I'd be comfortable clarifying that you account for it when it's probable, but I think it should be accounted for as a true-up adjustment, effectively a change in an estimate.
I have Andrew, Laurence, and Scott. Andrew?
I'm in a somewhat different place. We do observe some diversity in practice. Though I would agree with Tony that accounting for the more probable outcome is probably the more predominant practice from what we have seen. That said, if we decide to proceed with clarification, I fully agree that there are pros and cons to all the alternatives. This would not be my preferred alternative. I prefer to be consistent with the schemes where the counterparty has a choice of settlement method. I think that's in some ways neater. I think perhaps I'm spent too much time looking at IAS 32 issues, but I think you have no less a liability if the event that drives the settlement is outside your control compared to whether the counterparty has control over the event. The examples we do see in practice most commonly of these contingent outcomes are based on IPOs. You get shares if there's a successful IPO and cash if there isn't. And I'd agree with Scott that we don't see achieving a successful IPO as being within the control of the entity. But you couldn't say that either outcome is remote. One of the comment letters did talk about they see contingent cash settlement features which are based on remote events, but that's not what we see more commonly in practice. So the effect of that is you are going to get reclassifications quite often. If you put this proposal together with paper 14, which actually proposes to have a different approach to measuring fair value for a cash settled scheme compared to an equity settled scheme, I think that's quite a lot of complexity. That moving around between classifications. The example in paper six actually deals with that by assuming that no employees leave, so there are none of those vesting condition-based fair value adjustments. So while recognising that there's possibly no ideal solution, I think I'd prefer to use the existing technology in IFRS 2 for schemes where the counterparty has a choice, and I think that's much more consistent actually with the discussion we had at the last meeting about an IAS 32 instrument with a contingent cash settlement outcome.
Okay. Laurence and then Scott.
I don't think there is any neat solution that fits into the literature as we have it. There are pros and cons. You can't make it fit with IAS 32. You can't make it fit properly with IFRS 2, and particularly the alternative where it is the employee's choice. Because I do believe it is important to reflect the probability that it is cash settled or not, and that it would be not portraying faithfully those schemes if you had to recognize a liability that you would keep remeasuring, whereas you know that you won't be cash settling. So I'm definitely in favor of the approach that you propose. I think that those plans need a special treatment, and what you propose is fine. How do you treat changes? Because there will be reclassifications. We can debate, indeed, but I was happy with the staff proposal to treat it as a modification. I think it makes it simple.
Scott?
Like others, I think that the proposed solution to account for the award, the way that it is probable it will be settled, makes the most sense given all of the other options. It doesn't really follow from a principle. Rather, I think that what IFRS 2 does is, in general, it treats an award as either cash settled or stock settled unless the employee actually has a choice. That's the only time we kind of, account for the two. And that makes sense because that's a situation when we put somebody else in control. So it makes sense we could wind up with a higher liability there and possibly have to account for two components. Here we don't have that. It's going to be all one way or the other, and it's not based on somebody else's choice. I think accounting for what's probable makes sense. I do want to caution if anybody is favoring this answer because they think it converges with U.S. GAAP, just a caution. Remember, the definition of probable under U.S. GAAP is different. This will not achieve complete convergence. It's certainly more convergent than the other possible answers, but it's not going to get to convergence because for some reason we don't define probable in U.S. GAAP the way the dictionary does, and so it has to be at least 75% or so before it's probable. So it's a little bit confusing there. I see these most often in IPOs and change of control. That's in addition to what Andrew mentioned, change of control. Cash settlement on change of control seems to be a fairly common provision. Regarding reclassifications, I found it interesting the way you described the methods. One was treated as failure to satisfy a vesting condition. Well, it's clearly not that. It's not failure to satisfy a vesting condition. You worked. And the other is treated as a modification of the terms and conditions. Well, it's clearly not that either, because the terms and conditions didn't change. So I thought that the descriptions were just off. What those two methods identify, however, are two methods that are in the standard of how certain changes are handled. And so I think the question is, do we want to handle this change in classification the way we would handle a failure to satisfy a vesting condition, or the way we would handle a modification, or do we not like either of those and we have to make up a third way? I certainly agree with not making up a third way. It's already complicated enough. Let's pick one of the ways that exist. On balance, I prefer the proposal because I think we should leave the accounting that
applied in the past based on what we thought was probable during that times alone and not adjust it. But I can go the other way as well. But I wouldn't describe it as this is like a modification or like a failure to satisfy a vesting condition, because I don't think it's like either of those. We're just going to pick one of those methods.
Yeah, I haven't articulated it as well, but I found the same thing troubling. Reinhardt?
I agree with the others in terms of that, from my perspective, taking a probability-based approach makes sense. In terms of changes, my own view would be that it would make more sense to go with the method one, simply because a modification, although this is not a modification, but there have been no change to the terms and conditions. And the way I look at this is you have a single award and you've got two possible outcomes from the inception. So doing the cumulative catch type approach to me made sense. So I would prefer method one.
John and then Tony.
I support the staff using the IAS 37 approach. I don't really like bringing in IAS 32 concepts and trying to and apply them to IFRS 2, because I'm not sure what we would end up with at the end of the day trying to do that. So I think an IAS 37 probable approach is the way to go. And on the changes, again, I could go either way, but I'm happy enough with the modification, but I see arguments for the other. But I do think, as Scott said, neither of them, you know, doesn't neatly fit into one or the other. You're really just electing an approach to apply to these when the probability changes here or when you go over the threshold. So I was happy enough with modification accounting. I think it doesn't give an inappropriate answer, but I could support the alternative as well.
Tony, and then we'll try and put a ribbon on it.
I just wanted to come back on the which of the two approaches that you take, and I agree with what you said and what Scott said, that it doesn't fit naturally. And I guess my thinking around supporting the cumulative catch-up or whatever you call it approach was, one, it's much more simple than applying modification accounting. It's what's currently done predominantly in practice. Certainly that's our experience of where people are applying a let's choose the one that's probable approach. In practice, when they shift from one to the other, they are typically applying this approach. So what's being proposed would result in a change. And finally, I think it avoids creating any additional issues. So one of the things that, for example, if you have a successful IPO and you shift from being cash settled to equity settled, you've suddenly got a new question: what's grant date fair value? And I understand that there is a generic question when you shift from cash settled to equity settled. It exists at the moment. We'll just see it more often now if we go to the modification accounting to try and figure out what's grant date fair value. So I just think the cumulative catch-up is a much simpler approach, and others may disagree. I think it's the predominant approach that's used in practice at the moment.
Okay. I'm sensing general support for the probability-based trigger. Now, any objections to that? Kenichi, can you articulate for us, without using the labels in IFRS 2, the distinction between then the two approaches to dealing with the turnover? What makes them different? Can you articulate that for us?
For example, in the accounting results, as I said, method one is a catch-up adjustment type.
So method one gives you a catch-up adjustment, total hit to cumulative hit to P&L. Okay.
Then as if you had always applied.
As if you had always applied.
The model you're now applying.
Yeah. And the other approach?
Other approach would be change of classification, the account is in accordance with the requirements for the change in the terms and conditions of the share agreement. So
that doesn't give you. Yeah. Scott?
I would describe as method one is more focused on getting the total expense to reflect the ultimate manner of settlement. Method two treats each period more discreetly, says that the cost recorded in each period is whatever cost applies to the type of the award you thought you had in that period, and you don't go back and adjust it.
I didn't hear anybody passionately for either one, so let's just do a show of hands on first choice. What's your preferred approach? Method one, which I would describe as the cum catch-up approach. So can I have a show of hands that favored that as your first choice of an answer? And those who would favor the discrete year approach?
Four.
Okay. Clear majority for the cum catch-up.